You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as it's come to be known, is a technique for extracting natural gas that has both tremendous economic promise and is fraught with ecological peril. And we're joined now by ProPublica reporter Abram Lustgarten, Stu Gruskin, consultant and former executive deputy of New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, and Mark Bowling, an executive vice president, general counsel, and secretary at Southwestern Energy. They'll be participating in ProPublica panel on fracking, along with other experts, on April 9th, and I'm very pleased to welcome all three of them to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Abram,
thank you.
Briefly, can you explain how fracking works in most cases?
Yeah, fracking is a technique where fluid, chemicals, water, sand, or some other silica proppant is injected deep into the ground under extremely high pressure to frack and crack and break apart the geologic formation that holds gas trapped in tiny little bubbles and give it a method to flow back out of the well.
Have we been doing this for a long time, or is this a relatively recent practice?
Well, the technology's been evolving for a long time. It was invented decades ago, but it's really evolved in the last decade or so. It's now used much more frequently, and the technique has been refined. The volumes used are much, much larger, so it's a fairly different process than it used to be.
Has there also been a legislative breakthrough for the industry?
Well, there was. In 2005, the industry got an exemption from regulation under the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is a law that that regulates everything else that's pumped underground and carefully controls the pressure at which it's pumped underground.
Mark, how many wells does your company operate?
Well, in the Fayetteville Shale, we operate over probably 1,300.
Wow.
Maybe more than that.
And how many states are you in?
We're our largest project is in Arkansas, but we also have operations in Pennsylvania, in the northeast portion of Pennsylvania, some in Texas, and we're getting ready to drill a well in Colorado.
How much comes out of an individual well? Is this similar to what we saw with those oil wells that used to dot the Texas landscape in California?
No, I think it's a bit different. The question on what comes out of the well is can only be answered after you drill the well. You can come up with averages. Let's say for the Fayetteville Shale, you can say it may be three BCF of gas. It may be a little bit more in the Marcellus. It's quite a bit more than that in certain areas, and less than that in others. And then, of course, the Haynesville is even more than that.
So you measure them by cubic feet?
Yes, that's right.
Earlier this week, the EPA announced that it was delaying setting final air pollution standards for fracking. Stu, what substances are they concerned about being released into the air?
Well,
I mean, we'll get to the water later.
Right. Well, they're worried about various kinds of toxins that are inherent in the drilling process, and there has been quite a bit of controversy over how to regulate that and what the EPA's roles should be and what the state's roles should be.
Well, what kinds of health risks could it pose to people? We're talking about benzene being released into the air?
I'm not actually sure of all of the individual components that would be in the air pollution, but there would be any of the typical health risks that are associated with toxic materials. Of benzene, it would be cancer risk. There's asthma risk. There's a variety of health consequences from exposure to air emissions.
Mark, methane, isn't that also part of this greenhouse gas that's worse than CO2, I've heard.
Methane is certainly one of the things that are emitted at gas well sites. The various parts of the production process, including the fracking process, contribute to ozone pollutants, and there are benzene and other pollutants as well. And we do hear, it's very difficult to draw a connection, but we do hear a lot of complaints of deteriorating health and various symptoms in places where the drilling is happening.
Mark, are there easy ways to limit the amount of pollutants released into the air from a well?
Yes, there are. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I think is interesting is that I think we pretty much identify the emission types. There are the nitrogen oxides, sulfur dioxides, carbon monoxide. You mentioned the methane. And then various volatile organic compounds, which is like the BTEX, the benzene that you talked about. Obviously, it depends. Not all are going to have the VOCs like benzene because the type of gas may be a dry gas, and it won't have those higher chain hydrocarbons. But we do have reduction technologies that can take care of those. The only thing that we don't have agreement on, we know what the emissions are. We have reduction technology to take care of them. But the unusual thing is that we seem to have a disagreement as to what the emission levels actually are.
Now, your company seems to be more concerned than many about dealing with these issues. What about the rest of the industry? Are you willing to badmouth the competition?
Well, I don't know that I would call it badmouthing the competition. I guess what I would say is that my hope is that everyone realizes that in order for us to develop what I believe to be a very important supply of natural gas, something that's essential part of achieving a secure, low-carbon energy future, we all need to step up our game. And we need to have a proper balancing of the economic, environmental, and social impacts of our activities.
Now, in North Dakota today, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar said he hoped hydraulic fracturing won't become, and I'm using his phrase, an Achilles heel for the oil and gas industry. How could it become an Achilles heel?
Well, I think part of the way it could become an Achilles heel is the way industry has, to be honest with you, I'll take a shot at them for failing to deal with some of the questions that have come out. Say, for example, when everyone is wondering, and as well they should, whether or not hydraulic fracturing is harming underground sources of drinking water, all industry would say is, hey, we've done this for 60 years without a problem. Don't regulate us out of business, and there's no way hydraulic fracturing could be doing that. When the question that was unanswered, remained unanswered, is, well, if it isn't hydraulic fracturing that's causing methane to migrate into these water wells, then what did? And I think industry failed to step up and give information as to what is causing that.
Well, since you're concerned and your company is concerned, are you working out other approaches? And why wouldn't the whole industry try to do something similar?
Well, that's I'm not sure I can answer the last part of that question.
I mean, is it an economic matter? Is doing this safely more expensive?
Well, in some instances it is, in some instances it's not. I think the approach that we've taken is that in order to come up with the right balance that I talked about before, balancing the economic and environmental and social impact of our activities, you have to engage in environmental groups and regulators and get their perspective. And that's what we've been doing for the last little over 2 years with the Environmental Defense Fund in trying to come up with a model regulatory framework for hydraulic fracturing operations and dealing with other issues, the latest one being air emissions.
My guests are Mark Bowling, Executive VP at Southwestern Energy, Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica, and Stu Gruskin, a former executive deputy at the New York Department of Environmental Conservation. The EPA recently has received more than 150,000 comments on fracking. Stu, was there a similar level of public interest when you worked at the New York Department of Environmental Conservation?
Yes, there was. We started in 2008 by announcing that before there was going to be high-volume hydrofracking in New York State, The DEC was going to update the environmental rules that apply to this, and we wanted to do it in a very transparent way, engaging the public, engaging all the stakeholders in industry. With our first effort was a scoping exercise to determine kind of the table of contents for this. We got about 3,000 comments. We then did public hearings. We got about 13,000 or 14,000 comments. We came out with a draft. And then there was a new round of public hearings that the current administration got over 60,000 comments.
And so, most of those comments from people in the areas affected?
Well, it's a mix. The comments range from very comprehensive comments from industry and some of the larger environmental groups, New York City, and commenters who have the resources for a very comprehensive study, to individuals who are just filling out a postcard saying, do this or don't do this, which really isn't material, to be honest with you, to what DEC is deciding. This is not a popularity contest. It's not a referendum as to whether it should or should not be done. It's actually a technical administrative process to identify what the impacts are going to be and how to address those impacts.
One of the strongest images that comes to mind when we talk about fracking is explosive tap water, which has been featured in documentaries and news reports and on YouTube. Abram, should the environmental concerns be defined by that image? How extensive is that particular problem?
Well, I think the environmental concerns are much broader than that image, but it's certainly become symbolic, and it's frequent enough that I think it's a legitimate concern. Mark was just talking about methane seepage just a moment ago, and we see and hear of methane problems, methane emanating from wells or underground into water supplies in a number of places where gas is drilled for, from Colorado to Texas to Pennsylvania and in western New York as well. And it's an old and long established problem.
In some cases, hasn't the EPA had to ship in drinking water to people's homes?
They have. They're doing that now in Dimmick, Pennsylvania. The EPA has also indirectly supported the supply of water in Wyoming.
Stu, as somebody who is seeing the arguments from all sides, isn't there some debate about the extent to which groundwater and drinking water can be contaminated by fracking?
There's some debate as to what has been the cause of contamination. You mentioned a moment ago the iconic image of the tap water on fire. I was doing some research for one of my presentations, and I came across a picture on the internet of a tap with water on fire. It turns out it came from a 1982 edition of Waterwell Journal, talking about the historic presence of methane in drinking water. So from a regulatory standpoint, it's not enough to say there's a problem. You have to go further and say what caused the problem. And as with many industrial processes, if you don't do it right, there will be problems. So if you drill a well and you don't have proper casing, then methane is going to escape. If you build a sewage treatment plant and you don't have the tanks set up right, then fluids are going to escape from those tanks. It's really not fundamentally different from a regulatory perspective. It's an industrial process that needs to be controlled with very stringent, appropriate regulations that should be developed in an objective, scientific way.
Mark, as someone in the industry, is there anything you'd like to add?
I think Stu really kind of hit the nail on the head when he said that there are instances in which there's methane migration, and I think a lot of people talked around it when they said, oh, that's just biogenic gas, it's naturally occurring, et cetera, and others said, well, it's because of the hydraulic fracturing at 5,000 feet causing the methane to migrate. And when in reality we do have the science out there to check what that fingerprint that gas and determine where it is coming from. And as all things usually are, it's not black and white. It's not like, it was early portrayed that the drilling didn't have anything to do with it. And it's not as was otherwise portrayed that the fracking event itself, not the drilling, but the actual completion event was really causing it. And so I think we need to employ the type of technologies that are out there to identify exactly what's causing it and then make sure that the proper procedures are in place to prevent that from happening.
We're going to take a little break now, and we'll return to this discussion about the pros and cons of hydraulic fracturing with Mark Bowling, an executive vice president, general counsel, and secretary at Southwestern Energy, Stu Gruskin, a consultant and former executive deputy of New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, and Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica. Stay with us. We are back with Mark Bowling, who is an executive vice president at Southwestern Energy, Stu Gruskin, former executive deputy at New York's Department of Environmental Conservation, and Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica, who is also the author of a new book called Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. And Abram, we're not talking about BP right now, but do you see these things as linked?
Well, they're linked in the sense that a lot of what we're talking about is the oil and gas industry's ability to impose on themselves what Mark was referring to as best practices. There's a limit to what regulations can require, and there's always an opportunity to do things better. We hear often that those opportunities are available and the technology is available. So it was a decision for BP. It's a decision for gas drillers whether or not they want to spend the money and implement those practices.
Well, one of the most controversial aspects of it all is the fracking liquid mixture. How much do we know about its actual makeup?
Well, we know a lot more now than we used to. A couple of years ago, it was a complete mystery. The contents were entirely protected as trade secrets. They weren't disclosed to the public. There was a bit of an outcry. I wrote a lot about it, and the public was justifiably very concerned. Disclosure has increased substantially. There's a number of states, Colorado and Pennsylvania and Texas among them, that now require disclosure to some degree. And there's an industry contributing website called Frac Focus that lists the chemicals used in wells across the country. Disclosure is greatly improved. It's valuable information. It's not complete yet, and that still leaves some questions.
What about your company, Mark? Do you have full disclosure?
Yes, we do.
What are you putting into the ground then?
Now, what are we putting into the ground? Well, we're putting probably about 99.5% water and sand. We put in a lubricating chemical that allows you to not use as high as pump pressure. You don't have to have as many machines out there. Then we have something called a surfactant, which allows the water to clear up. Or the fluids to clean up and come back up to the surface, and then in order to kill off the sulfur creating organisms and bacteria, we have a bactericide.
Sue, what about EPA guidelines on wastewater? Are there any?
Not that would be I think applicable in. In terms of disclosure of the frac fluids, that's something that really is up to the states. And one of the important points to make is that the states have the ability to require, for example, this kind of disclosure. And New York made it clear from the very start that if an operator wanted to drill a well in New York State, then DEC would need to know everything that's going into the ground.
Now, listeners have been writing in, and I'd like to read some of their questions. Antonio in Bayside asks on our show page, is there a way to use chemicals that are not toxic? Am I wrong to suspect that the fracking industry uses chemicals, some bad chemicals, because it's cheaper? Mark?
Well, to answer the first part of the question, yes, several of the fracking companies are working feverishly to provide substitutes for the types of chemicals that I just mentioned to you that really perform those types of roles in the process and make them greener and biodegradable. And they know how important it is, and they're moving on it. I think that a question, I'm not sure I can answer the question in terms of the whether or not there's other alternatives out there that are greener but cost more, because I just don't know of them. I think as they become available, I think that industry players will use them. Because it's important to do so.
The EPA recently declared the water in Dimlock, Pennsylvania, which is a fracking hotspot, safe to drink. But, Abram, in a recent report, didn't you note that the agency neglected to tell anyone that it had high levels of methane?
Yeah, that's right. The EPA very informally issued a statement that said that it wasn't finding contaminants that were of great health concern endemic. It set out to sample 60 homes. It had results from 11 of them, a very small pool that had come back. I did see the test results for those 11 homes, or for six of the 11 homes, and while they did not have very high levels of concerning contaminants, they had carcinogenic chemicals in them, for example, and a number of them were detected in a number of wells, and they also had methane at levels that could be explosive that were considered very high.
So is the EPA being industry friendly in this case?
Well, it really appeared that way at the outset, and I've had a number of conversations with folks over at EPA's Region 3 since that article. Their perspective is that they're trying to share information as quickly as they possibly can with the public. What they said to me explicitly about this situation is that they goofed, that they regretted how they unfurled the information, but I don't think that it really came from bad intentions, and we'll have to see what happens as the next wave of results are released.
Well, who is going to do most of the regulating, the federal government or the individual states? Some states are right now talking about having very little money. Can they budget serious regulation?
In order to be effective, the states are going to have to do that, and that means they're going to have to be looking at severance taxes or extraction fees, ways of getting the funding for it. The reality is that there is not going to be a national permitting program for this kind of drilling. I think that EPA has an important role to play in setting baseline standards and in holding the state's feet to the fire. And when you look at the various ways EPA has been involved with this, I think that what EPA Region 2 has been doing in New York, which is providing comments and basically helping the state regulators, that's a good role and the right approach for EPA.
On the other hand, don't aquifers cover a number of different states? So it would be really hard. That's almost like oil under Iraq and Kuwait, the same pool of oil. The federal government would have to play a major role in that sort of thing, wouldn't it, Abram?
I agree with Stu that on the ground regulation is going to come from the states, because those are the entities that have inspectors there to do work. But there's a role for federal oversight, and one important role that it plays is under the Safe Drinking Water Act, the requirement that states control what's injected underground and under how much pressure, and that's explicitly a law that was explicitly written to protect underground aquifers and sources of drinking water after a large history of contamination instances were found in the 1980s. And until states have that baseline set by the federal government, you won't see them control the fracturing and drilling process specifically under that underground injection program.
We're talking about fracking with Abram Lustgarten of ProPublica, Stu Gruskin, former executive deputy at the New York Department of Environmental Conservation, and Mark Bowling, executive VP at Southwestern Energy. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Earlier this year, a New York State court ruled for the first time that towns have the right to ban drilling, despite a state regulation asserting that they cannot. Sue, why are some localities in Albany at such odds over fracking?
Well, this really is a question of home rule, and there are communities in the state where there's the potential for gas drilling that just do not wish to have it. And it may be not necessarily because of the potential environmental impacts, but there are other impacts also, community impacts, that socioeconomic impacts that they don't want in their communities. So they've asserted that they have the ability to ban this. There's a state law that reserves to the state, it preempts local governments. And so these cases are now going to they've been appealed, and ultimately the courts are going to decide the extent to which the state, under the public policy theory that mineral resources should not be controlled at the local level but at the state level, that'll get determined by the courts.
In this particular case, an energy company, Anschutz Exploration, sued the city of Dryden for prohibiting fracking in its jurisdiction. Abram, how confrontational are these local municipalities getting with the energy companies? And don't they make a case if they feel that their water supply is going to be contaminated?
Well, the Anschutz case is interesting. You know, as Stu pointed out, it's precedent setting. It's very difficult in New York because there isn't yet a history of this type of drilling and this type of long, deep horizontal wells. So it's hard for townships like Dryden to bring their own personal fact-based experience to those arguments. But this is definitely setting up to be an intense fight. And one of the immediate and quick responses you saw to that lawsuit in New York was across the state border in Pennsylvania, where the state legislature just passed a rule prohibiting municipalities from doing exactly what's happening in New York.
Mark, do you think these towns and cities are missing out on any of the potential economic rewards that come from drilling?
Well, that's a really good question, and I don't know that I'd say that they're if they are making their decisions to ban hydraulic fracturing based on disinformation or information that isn't accurate, yes, then they're missing out. But if they are actually looking at the truth associated with hydraulic fracturing, which it is an industrial process, there are going to be impacts to the local communities. You're going to have truck traffic. You're going to have road damage. There are going to be things that the local community is going to have to deal with. If they recognize all that and also look at the benefits and say, yeah, it's not so much for our community, then I can't fault them for that. As long as they're making an informed decision about whether they want that in their community or not, that's really all you can ask.
Stu, Joe from Bayside asks, please ask why this industry asked for and got an exemption from abiding from the Clean Water Act if this process is safe for our groundwater. Why get this exemption? What are they afraid of?
Well, the fact is there actually is not an exemption from the Clean Water Act. Abram referred previously to the Safe Drinking Water Act and the underground injection. At that point in time, when the law was amended, it didn't cover this industry. I assume that's because it was in the industry's interest. As I will often tell people, in the state of New York, it does not matter one bit that New York State is able to act independent of that. And from the start, we've made it clear that we will. So regardless of what happened, at that time in the federal lawmaking process, doesn't matter to us.
The American Petroleum Institute recently released a statement saying, we're concerned that there are now 10 separate federal government agencies looking to study and potentially add new and unnecessary layers of regulations on hydraulic fracturing. More regulation could increase costs and delays for operators. Mark, would more environmental regulation make developing natural gas economically unfeasible?
No, I don't believe so. I believe that as long as the regulations are effective and they're smart regulations, obviously there can be, regulating something just for the sake of regulating it or thinking that it has a benefit doesn't help anyone. But smart regulation where we have legitimate concerns about the way things are being done and we want to make sure that there's a level playing field so that everyone is held to the same standard, I think that makes sense.
Now, the price of natural gas has dropped recently to nearly a 10-year low. Mark, will that price drop stall any new fracking projects?
Oh, it most assuredly will. I think that we're seeing a lot of movement away from the dry gas developments to either liquids-rich natural gas or oil. So I think the sheer economics of it, when you're taking a look at what it costs to drill a well, complete that well, and produce it at these prices, I don't see how many of the projects that, a year ago looked good, I don't see how they can look good now.
Why are natural gas prices at record lows while gasoline prices are high enough to become part of the presidential campaign?
Well, I think that's it really gets to supply and demand. I think that what has happened to the industry is that we're getting a backlash from our own success in being able to figure out technologically how to get gas out of very tight formations. And a lot of folks have continued to drill. I think a lot of that drilling, even though it wasn't necessarily economic, was being done because it was continued being done because a lot of money was paid for the leases.
Go ahead.
And so they needed to do that. And so we've just flooded the market with a lot of natural gas.
So in light of this glut, wouldn't it be best to wait in New York State until the price went up? And is it likely that safer fracking methods will have been developed by that time?
Well, I don't think that New York's environmental review should be dependent upon what the price of gas is at any particular time. And I should say natural gas is at any particular time. New York has not been rushing this. We've been at it now for close to 4 years. And I think the timeline that New York's been on is to take as much time as is needed to do it right and not more than that.
Abram, what about the problem of leakage from wells? How extensive is it and what are the risks?
Well, it's really difficult to know, which is the scariest thing about it. I mean, we hear reports of degrading water quality in many, many places where drilling happens. It's how my reporting started years ago. We know that well structure problems can lead to leaking, that casing and cementing failures are frequent, are common, and do allow fluids from the wells to leak out. We know that the forces exerted by hydraulic fracturing, the incredible pounds per square inch that are pushed into the well, can exacerbate those fractures and can lead to increased leaking, and it also causes, you know, vibrations and cracking underground that can cause natural contaminants to flow into water supplies. So there's adequate cause for concern and a dearth of scientific research.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and Paul Gallet wrote a letter to the editor in the New York Times recently in which they said numerous studies show that drill-friendly communities underperform their neighbors in income, employment, education, and investment. I guess we could see that both ways. The more welcoming communities would be ones that are poor to begin with, or the suggestion here is that once they allow the drilling in, it hurts the community. What do you think?
Well, this is often portrayed as, I think, a false choice between economic benefit and environmental protection, and it really doesn't need to be that way. But if we want to talk about the economic benefit, and surely there is huge economic benefits in all of the communities where this drilling is taking place, I really think that it needs to include the economic costs associated with the environmental implications, whether that's fixing the roads or doing the scientific studies or the long-term health care costs.
Or whether it leads to earthquakes, as some people have suggested. Mark, one more question.
Sure.
The White House records show that representatives from your company, Southwest Energy, and others have met with the Obama administration officials at least 3 times in the last 2 weeks. Is the White House hoping to move fracking projects ahead as we get closer to the election, where the phrase drill, baby, drill is likely to be thrown around a lot?
Oh, I don't think so. I think what the White House is trying to do, which I believe is very appropriate, is to the EPA has the NSPS rules that just came out, and they're trying to get those implemented. And some questions have come up in the comments to those rules that I think are concerns that the administration wants to make sure they hear out and see whether they're legitimate or not. And so that's kind of what has been going on there. They've been asking, and to their credit, they have been asking for input from industry, from environmental groups, et cetera, to say, okay, let's see if we can ferret out what is reality from fiction and make sure that what we're doing is going to be beneficial to the environment and won't harm the industry.
And won't have too many political aftershocks.
Sure.
Abram, we have seen the environmental damage caused by mining. Once the mines are left, what's left behind at these sites after all the natural gas has been extracted?
Well, the well site, it appears fairly benign. It's a fairly small facility after all the drilling is done and gone. You'll have the pad itself, which is a couple acres that's been disturbed and will eventually grow back. I think the real danger and the real question is what happens underground.
Will the aquifer ever be able to replenish itself because so much water is used in this process?
Well, there's two sides to that equation. Whatever water has been drawn down to support the drilling process, processes. Is there sufficient supply? And if it's drawn from an aquifer, will it replenish? But also, there's a really unresolved, unanswered question about what happens with the chemicals, with the fluids, with even the brines or natural contaminants that are left underground, and whether they do move. And that's something we might not see an answer to for many, many decades.
Thank you all so much for being with us. Abram Lustgarten is at ProPublica and also the author of a new book called Run to Failure, BP and the Making of the Deepwater Horizon Disaster. Stu Gruskin is a consultant, former executive deputy at New York State's Department of Environmental Conservation. Mark Bowling is an executive vice president, general counsel, and secretary at Southwestern Energy. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.